All right, we are in the middle of Jesus Was a Mystic, and it's kind of a weird series because it's mystical, duh. So we don't know how long it's going to last. We don't know where it's going, but I've enjoyed it a lot, and today we're going to keep on. This is our sixth week now. And just to recap for you who have been here or haven't been here, first week we talked about just a lot about experience and taste. And a lot of the Bible is filled with stories of experience and tasting God. And when you try to put those things into words, they don't always work. And so if we come at the Bible with logic and reason all of the time, that can sometimes get us into a little bit of trouble. Then we talked about the idea of focusing on the little things that we often do, like beliefs and doctrines and theology, and missing the bigger things of life, like experience. We talked about language and how language, just the way we speak, can hinder our experience and our theology and our views of God. We spent some time considering different things. As Jesus said, consider the lilies. We spent some time just almost meditating and experiencing. And then we talked about building on a firm foundation. And a lot of that foundation is about, again, experience and taste. And so if you take the theme of the first 5 weeks, it's been a lot about experience and taste. And belief is kind of, whatever, belief. Right? It's kind of been the gist of it. But then you come to verses like these that talk a lot about belief. Of course, this one, for God so loved the world that he gave his one and only Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have everlasting life. Matthew 8, then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And his servant was healed at that moment because he believed. Then this story, this one's awesome. Mark 9, man comes to Jesus, his son is possessed, and he's begging and saying, Jesus, I mean, if you can do anything, if you can, and Jesus says, if you can? Who knew Jesus was a little sassy, a little sarcastic? Whoa, if you can? Seriously, are you talking to me? Everything is possible for one who believes. And there are 100 verses just in the Gospels that talk about belief and the importance of belief. And so surprisingly, none of you have come up to me in the first 5 weeks and said, Ryan, I know you're talking about experience and taste, but don't we need to believe something? You can come up and critique me anytime. Actually, just not after the service, later in the week. So belief, what do we do with this? Well, here's a little story. Hermann Göring was second in command to Hitler, leader of the Nazi party. And he was very into art, very into collecting art, just like Hitler. And he especially loved the painter Vermeer, who was in the 1600s. And to find Vermeer's art was very hard, very difficult. Not many of them existed. But eventually, Göring came across a painting, and it looked like this, Jesus and the Adulteress, which, I don't know, I find this painting very creepy. It would make sense that a leader of the Nazi party would love it. So he found this painting and he loved it, and it was a Vermeer. He paid, in today's dollars, $7 million for this painting. And this was his favorite. This was his, you just look at it and beautiful. Now, after the war, Allied forces found a lot of Hitler's artwork as well as a lot of Göring's artwork. And in particular, this one was of interest because it had been sold to him by a Dutchman. This Dutchman was found, and he was accused of treason for selling a Vermeer piece of art that belonged to the Dutch government. Well, the man who sold him the artwork, who was being tried for treason, came and said, well, actually, it's not treason you should try me for, because this painting isn't real. It's a forgery. I painted it myself. I've spent years, it's amazing to look at this guy, spent years perfecting the art of the classics, went and found the same materials, the canvases, so it would look just like an original Vermeer. And he said, I'll prove it, and he painted another one while in jail. So they accused him of forgery instead of treason, and he was pretty much a hero to the Dutch. But it's said when Göring was being tried for war crimes, and he was eventually committed to death, when he found out that this painting was not real. I believe the quote from his biographer goes something like, it was as though he realized there was evil in the world for the first time. Yeah. But it is amazing. He was devastated because this painting he believed to be real was not. Now, you can run all kinds of experiments, and these are so fun to talk about. Kids, food. If you want a kid to enjoy food, you tell them the food is from McDonald's. And they will actually enjoy and taste the food differently. They've run experiments. Yes, these carrots are from McDonald's. Ooh, these are delicious. And you laugh and you say, well, that's just kids. Same things work for adults. Wine tasting. If you tell an adult that the wine is expensive, it will actually trigger certain parts of the brain differently than a wine that is not expensive. They've run tests. They put adults in MRI machines and feed them wine through a tube and tell them, this is an expensive wine. And when they do, the reward centers of the brain are just going crazy. Which means what we believe about something actually affects our experience and literally our taste. So psychologists will make statements like this. We don't just respond to things as we see them or feel them or hear them. Rather, our response is conditioned on our beliefs about what they really are, where they came from, what they're made of, what their hidden nature is. Whoa. So beliefs do matter and do affect us, which when you get into the case of brand names, it starts to get very depressing. Because when we believe something about a certain shirt, certain shoe, certain whatever, it actually, we experience it as better. So we're all just being programmed by brands, and that's depressing. But rather than be depressed, we could think about that differently and say, man, what does that really mean then when Jesus says, if you believe in me? That might affect our experience. So we could stop there, or we could keep going, and we could talk about, well, what is the brand of God? What is the brand of Christianity? This is another really fun study. There's going to be a lot of fun studies this morning, because I'm into them right now. So this one was really good. They took a bunch of kids, hundreds of kids, and they had them pick out toys behind a little wall, and they would make a sound, and then the kid would have to decide what toy was making the sound. During the experiment, the researcher would leave and allow the kids to cheat and look behind the wall and see what toys there were. Then the researcher would come back into the room. And the researcher would tell the kids one of three stories, depending on what group they were in. One of the stories was about Pinocchio. You all know the story of Pinocchio. When Pinocchio lies, his nose grows longer, and everyone makes fun of him. Don't lie. Boy who cried wolf. Little boy lies. Little boy lies. And eventually everyone dies in a bloodbath because of his lies. I mean, kids, don't lie. Your whole family could be eaten by wolves. Third story, George Washington and the cherry tree. Now, this one's a little different. George goes out with his new axe, cuts down the father's favorite cherry tree, or a cherry tree, and his dad loved cherry trees. His dad finds out, little George feels bad, he comes to his dad, Dad, I'm so sorry, I cut down your tree, and his father says, no, it's so much more important that you were honest with me than any cherry tree. Two of the stories are very negative, one of the stories is very positive. Turns out, and I won't go into all the depths of the experiment, turns out the negative stories do not affect kids and whether they will lie or not, at all. There's no difference. Tell the kids that story, yep, they lie just like they always do. Tell the kids the George Washington story, about a 20% less chance they will lie, which leads researchers to say things like this about the study. Our results indicate that extolling the positive consequences of honesty rather than emphasizing the negative consequences of dishonesty can promote honest behavior in your children. Rewarding honesty appears to be more effective than punishing dishonesty. And again, there are numerous experiments that would affirm this. So rewarding honesty is better than punishing dishonesty. which makes you question things like, what about a faith whose main motivation was avoiding a punishment? How would that work? If that's the main motivation, maybe not very well. Okay, so we could stop there, or we could keep going, and this is another favorite one of mine. Candle experiment, it's very old, from the 60s. You put three or four adults in a room, and they have three items: a candle, a box of tacks, and a matchbox. And the goal is to affix the candle to the wall, lit, and not let it drip any wax on the floor. So I won't tell you how you solve the study, but eventually adults figured out, and you have to think a little bit out of the box to do that. You have to be motivated by creative thinking. Now, way back when they did the study and they started telling people, hey, listen, certain groups of people, you group, we're going to tell you that if you finish this experiment in the top 20% of speed, you will get a money bonus. Back in the 60s, we'll give you $25. Everyone in the group will get $25 if you finish this thing faster. And then they told them, and if you are the fastest group to finish it, you will get $50. So now they're being motivated by money. What happened? All of the groups that were motivated by money finished the experiment 3.5 minutes slower. And this is really weird. Experiment after experiment has been done. Money is a terrible motivator. Money never works. Of course, certain sustenance levels, but if you're rewarding based on more money, it doesn't work. And it's leading researchers, business experts, all kinds of people to say things like this. This was one of my favorite things. These are what motivate human beings: autonomy, the urge to direct our own lives; mastery, the desire to get better and better at something that matters; and purpose, the yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves. What if there was a faith that urged people to direct their own lives, empowered humans to get better and better at something that matters, because a lot of things matter in the world and you can get better and better at it, and to have a purpose that is much larger than yourself? What might that do as far as motivation? So you kind of take all of these things and you say, wow, okay, if we combine them all together, what we believe affects our experience and our taste in really important ways. And often what we believe, if we believe there's some kind of reward, or if we believe there's something that can benefit us, there's a joy that can come versus just avoiding a punishment, then we're more likely to follow that belief, experience, and taste. And even more so if we're motivated by this empowerment of ourselves to do things, to get better at things that matter in the world, and to do things that are larger than ourselves and to affect the entire world, then wow, we might be going someplace cool. So then, do we believe those things? And then you could say, well, yeah, sometimes we do. So I want to take five things this morning really quickly and maybe combine all of these, some more studies: belief, experience, taste, and looking at these a little bit differently of Jesus speaking in a mystical way. And maybe we can leave at least believing some things more, and then hopefully, again, not stopping there, but experiencing and tasting God in different ways. First one is money. We don't talk about money a ton here. Every now and then we do. Money is amazing, and there are some incredible experiments, one of which I already talked about a little bit, but here's one of my other favorites. This one's mind-boggling. Take adults, have them play a game of Monopoly. There's two players in the game. They flip a coin at the beginning of the game. One of the adults will be in the power position, one of them will be in the weak position for this game. The power position, they get to roll two dice, they get twice as much money, and they get the little Rolls-Royce token. The weak position, one die, half the money, and they get the little thimble or the one that's shoe, you know, the one nobody wants. They play 15 minutes, just a 15-minute game. And of course, the power position's raking in the dough. And they start interviewing the players. You know, why'd you win? And the people in the power position start saying, well, you know, I bought the right property. You know, I'm pretty good at this game. I mean, I know how to get around the board. I purchased this property. I mean, you know, I'm kind of a stud Monopoly player. Let's be honest. Over and over, 15 minutes, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of the boss here. The weaker player. Very few people said, well, I won because we flipped a coin in the beginning and the coin said I would win. Which led the researchers to make this statement. As a person's level of wealth increases, their feelings of compassion and empathy go down, and their feelings of entitlement, of deservingness, and their ideology of self-interest increases. You're going, whoa, 15 minutes in a Monopoly game and this happens? Does it go beyond that? Answer, yes. Researchers will give random strangers $10 and say, you can give this $10 to anybody you want. It's up to you. That's the experiment. Hey, here's 10 bucks. Give it to anyone you want. Oh, by the way, what do you make? People who make between $15,000 and $25,000 a year, not a lot of money, give 40% more of the money away than people who make $150,000 and above. Like, what? Wait. 10 bucks, you make $150,000 or more, and you are giving less than the person who gets $15,000 to $25,000 a year. Candy jar. They have adults come in and they say, oh, this candy right here, don't take any of the candy. It's for a kid's experiment we're doing later. The more money you make, people who made $100,000 or more were twice as likely to take candy out of the jar than people who did not. And you start going over and over and over. There's a crazy one about driving cars, too. People who drive nicer cars are just meaner. And yes, if you're offended and you drive a nice car here, that's okay. I'm looking out for you. I'm watching always. Amazing, amazing stuff about what money does. And then you come to verses and things that Jesus said like this. No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. And we often read this in a very negative way. If you're rich, you better be careful. You can't be serving God. And yet, what if you take that in a positive way and say, ah, no, see, when you're serving money, things actually happen to you that affect your levels of joy and happiness and life. Pretty cool. Another one is just stuff. Stuff. Americans have 3.5 more times more space than we did 50 years ago. So we all, on average, have much more space than we did. There's now a $2.2 billion square foot industry in America called storage. $22 billion industry of storing more stuff, even though we have more space to store the stuff that we're storing in there than we need. Wow, we need more stuff, more storage. And Americans are no happier. We're not any happier with more stuff and more space and more space to store more stuff. And there's a whole movement coming just in the secular world of saying, no, we're making smaller homes, smaller apartments. There's a whole apartment complex being built in Brazil right now with 400 square foot apartments that are made incredibly smart. Beds fold up, couches, tables come out. Because it makes them happier. We have too much space, we have too much stuff. And then you read things like this that Jesus said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And again, we often, better be careful. And yet there's this beautiful just, all this language you're receiving, you need more stuff and more and more. Yeah, it doesn't work. It actually affects you, and it affects your capacity to experience life and joy. How about this one, just being present? Another amazing study, and actually you can partake in it. It's an iPhone app. And they'll send you messages and ask you for your level of happiness the instant before you get the text message. So it wants to rate your happiness. So you're on a subway, you're at home eating dinner, you're wherever, just zzz. Okay, one instant before, how happy were you? And they ask you some questions. Thousands and thousands and thousands of responses. And what they have found is that the less your mind is wandering in a certain situation, the happier you are. And it doesn't matter whether it's a good or bad situation. It doesn't matter whether it's really something you like doing or you don't like doing. But the more present you are, the more your mind is there, literally the happier you are. Which is often why suffering, people will talk about it in such a glorious, moving way, because suffering, we're there, we're present, we're aware. Our mind is not wandering because we're focused even on pain. Then you read quotes again like this one we've heard a million times. Therefore, do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Oh, no. Don't worry about then. No matter what it is, don't worry about out there, just right now. And there's this beautiful happiness, joy, peace that comes from just that. Sabbath, rest. This one's been talked about a million times, but again, a whole movement, obviously, which I hope grows bigger and bigger, of just to slow down. We're in an adrenaline-addicted world. Chaos, movement, action, accomplishment. Go, 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 go. And if you stop, if you rest, if you're not working, you're lazy. If you take a Sunday to do absolutely nothing, I don't know, or a day or an evening, or if you take off from work so often, I can't do that. And we've got our phones now. We have constant work, accomplishment, adrenaline hits. It's even been said that every time you get an email, you get a little hit of adrenaline because, what's happening? Somebody cares. Somebody's responding to me. Someone's noticing me. I'm doing something that matters. I'm working out. It's so hard to just... Notice how you read your books to your kids. You ever find yourself just blazing through the book? And then, okay, love you, honey. Good night. I gotta go. I gotta go watch TV. Okay, yeah, sleep good. Such a great time if you have kids to just, okay, maybe I'm just gonna read this book slow. Yeah, I've read it 100 times and it bores the heck out of me, but I'm going to be present and slow down and stop doing anything else. And again, Jesus, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. I've heard that line a million times. The day of stopping was made for you. We don't even think about things like that very often. No, God made a day to just not do anything for you, to benefit you, to bring you joy and happiness and life. And then the last one, gratefulness. It's an amazing talk from this Brother David Stahl in, I don't know where he lives, on the East Coast somewhere, on gratefulness. Encourage you to listen to it. But he says, happiness does not bring gratefulness. Gratefulness brings happiness. Are we grateful? Towards the end of his talk, he gives this line, which I'll just read for you. It's so good. If you're grateful, you're not fearful. And if you're not fearful, you're not violent. You could just think about that one all day. If you're not afraid, you're not violent. If you're grateful, you act out of a sense of enough and not of a sense of scarcity, and you're willing to share. If you're grateful, there's plenty to go around. If you're grateful, you're enjoying the differences between people and you're respectful to everybody, and that changes this power pyramid under which we live. and it does not make for equality, but for equal respect. Again, when we're grateful, the hierarchy is equal respect. And then he says this, grateful people are joyful people. And we talk about being grateful so often in church, and even then it's sometimes this negative, like, well, you better be grateful or else. And yet, no, there's so much benefit, life, happiness, peace, that just comes from being grateful and believing that you are grateful and experiencing gratefulness. So we could go on all day. We'll do more of these as the summer goes on. The question is, do we believe it? It does matter. Because if we believe it, it affects our experience of it. And I want to end with this quote from the Lego movie. I think the Lego movie might be one of my favorite movies of all time. I love that movie. It's so good. I just watched it the other night again, and I was like, this movie, if you have not seen it, get out there and see it. Okay? It is so smart. It is so profound. And you're like, why are these guys saying stuff more profound than half the Christian books I read? Maybe 90% of the Christian books I read. This stuff is amazing. Lego movie ends with this line. And if you haven't seen it, too bad, I'm going to blow it for you, kind of. This line, just listen to this line. You don't have to be the bad guy. You are the most talented, most interesting, and most extraordinary person in the universe. And you are capable of amazing things because you are the special. And so am I, and so is everyone. The prophecy is made up, which is kind of funny if you look at that on a Christian perspective. But let's not go there. The prophecy is made up, but it's also true. It's about all of us. Right now, it's about you. And you still can change everything. That right there is as good as it gets. That's a sermon in itself. Read it for yourselves and ask yourselves, do I believe that? Just read it. Read it again. Do I believe every line there? Well, I'm not the most talented. I'm not the most interesting. I'm not really the most extraordinary person, especially in the universe. Probably not even in this room. Capable of amazing things? Sometimes. I'm kind of special if I'm feeling good. So is everyone. Whoa, no. Okay. I may not be the special, but I know for sure they're not either. I'm at least more special than them. Is it really about me right now? Can I still change everything? I don't know. I don't know. My path's pretty set. If you believe that, which, by the way, I believe this is what God says to all of us. We've said it a lot here in different ways. This is what God says to you this morning. I don't care who you are, where you've been, what you're doing. This is what God says to you. You believe that, you will start to experience and taste God in ways that you have never experienced and tasted God in this world, and you will start to change everything. It will change everything. Let's pray. This morning, I'm actually going to ask you to pray. So we're going to take 1 minute, and you pray. Think about something. Talk to God about something. Or maybe just sit there and let God speak to you. But we're going to end with you praying in your closet, experiencing God this morning. God, many people said it to Jesus, help us believe. That is our prayer this morning, so that we might experience and taste. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Have an awesome week. Go in grace and peace. And remember, we'll see you in 2 weeks, not next week. Have a good one.